It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at the latest in national politics, from lawmakers fighting on Capitol Hill over President Trump's cabinet picks to the ongoing immigration ban controversy and more.
First, President Trump made a long-awaited announcement last night. He named federal appellate court judge Neil Gorsuch as his Supreme Court nominee. Gorsuch, who is from Colorado, will fill the seat left vacant after the death of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia.
Trump praised Gorsuch as a worthy successor to Scalia last night. Here is the nominee speaking about the late justice last night after the president announced his nomination.
The towering judges that have served in this particular seat of the Supreme Court, including Antonin Scalia and Robert Jackson, are much in my mind at this moment. Justice Scalia was a lion of the law. Agree or disagree with him, all of his colleagues on the bench cherish his wisdom and his humor. And like them, I miss him.
Gorsuch seems like a popular choice so far among conservatives. Democrats are expected to put up a fight, especially after President Obama's nominee for Supreme Court, Merrick Garland, was stonewalled effectively by Senate Republicans. Joining us now to tell us more about the future of the nation's highest court, we have Kimmy King with us. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to the show.
Hello, public radio.
Well, Antonin Scalia's replacement, Gorsuch, potentially future Justice Gorsuch, how does he compare to his likely predecessor here?
In many ways, he is like Scalia. He is an originalist. He believes in looking at the text of the Constitution to make determinations about how it should be interpreted. It's also striking that Scalia could be critical of the legislature and question the extent to which you could divine constitutional rights from legislative intent. He has the judicial pedigree. He is a Harvard Law grad with a BA from Columbia and a graduate degree from Oxford. So he has that kind of judicial elite background that we look for. Not only that, but he's out of the Tenth Circuit, considered to be somewhat more conservative, and so he has the judicial credentials in terms of having already been a federal appellate judge. So in many ways, it is an appropriate fit for the Republicans to put him forward.
Resume, it seems like there's not much question. He's got that kind of background, but a lot of people, of course, are going to look at ideological leanings, precedent, things he's ruled on in the past. He's fairly young as Supreme Court justices go. How much do we know about his rulings in the past?
We actually know a fair amount about him, but we don't know the specific details in any given case. And that's actually the case with virtually every candidate that gets put up on the court. One of the things that conservatives are very concerned about is what we call the Souter effect. David Souter was put on with people thinking that they understood his conservative credentials, and then he got on the court and he didn't turn out to be like that. And so that's what conservatives are concerned about. Liberals, on the other hand, point to a few key things. His decision regarding reproductive birth control in the Hobby Lobby case at the lower level, as well as a very well thought out book that he did on the ethics of physician assisted suicide and euthanasia. So they point to that and say, aha, he has a pro-life bent. But to go back to your original question, at this point, it doesn't matter what the legal issues are. We've stopped having Supreme Court nominations and arguably lower federal court nominations being a function of legal philosophy, and long ago they became an issue of political bantering between the Republicans and the Democrats.
Looking at the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court, Kimmy King is with us from the University of North Texas. Let's look at those political calculations in the Senate, who will have to confirm him. Republicans, this is payday for them in a lot of ways, isn't it? Conservatives in Congress, unsure about everything Donald Trump was going to do. That Supreme Court question, who he was going to appoint, really seemed to sway a lot of people. This is what they were looking for, wasn't it?
Yes, and this is something that became a hallmark really last year when the Republicans indicated that they were going to take a delay on the nomination, and it's a function of increased acrimony that we've seen between Republicans and Democrats on the Judiciary Committee that from, I think, virtually everyone's perspective, doesn't serve anybody really well. Remember that the Democrats back in 2013, because of what they felt were, you know, Republican obstructionist tactics, invoked the nuclear option, meaning that instead of getting the normal 60 votes, which had been in place for almost four decades, they began saying that it just had to be a simple majority for nominations to the Supreme Court because they felt like Republicans were blocking a bunch of Obama's nominations. Harry Reid, then Senate Majority Leader, was warned by the Republican leadership at that time, be careful about going nuclear. It will come back to bite you. And that's one of the specters that has been raised by President Trump with his acknowledgement that they could just go nuclear.
As I understand it, the nuclear option was for, in effect, everything but the Supreme Court. It was for lower court judges, but we haven't seen that happen for Supreme Court justices
correct.
Yet.
To clarify that, and in general, I mean, the way to think of it is that it's a parliamentary procedure that allows the U.S. Senate to kind of, you know, this requirement that you have to have a supermajority of 60 votes in order to have it be accomplished, because that's 60 votes is needed to close off debate. You can't actually vote on it until that debate has been closed off.
Looking at it from the perspective of those Democrats now, they can filibuster and risk the nuclear option being invoked. Is there going to be some ill will given that we had just shy of a year of Merrick Garland's nomination sitting in limbo, never even brought to hearings or a vote? Are they going to be looking for payback if possible?
I would argue that it doesn't really matter what the Democrats or the Republicans do. They are going to be continually in this state of frenzy towards each other about ill will. So it's not clear that no matter what happens, that there won't be ill will and that there won't be payback. I think one of the things to be careful about is remember that some folks on the Trump side had wanted someone that wasn't one of the judicial elites. They wanted a common person. They liked the candidates that Trump put forward in his original list of 21 people as folks that had held political positions, that had run for office, that had something other than a judicial background. So there are Trump folks who are kind of, Gorsuch is one of those elites. But then you also have Democrats concerned that he will be a radical conservative and could tip the balance of power. And remember that, you know, Harriet Myers back in 2005 got dinged by a Republican Senate because it was thought that she didn't have the credentials that were needed and she didn't come from the judicial elites. So on both sides of the aisle, there's unhappiness. The question is how they are pointing the finger at each other.
People have pointed out that Gorsuch has worked with a couple of Supreme Court justices in the past, Justice White and Justice Kennedy. Now, Justice Kennedy in the conservative side of the court, but often seen as a swing vote. People have been speculating, hey, this guy knows him. Maybe that will help pull Kennedy to the right. Are things that simple?
It's never that simple between a mentor and a mentee. And remember, Gorsuch has had a long, distinguished career separate and apart from someone who was his mentor in a limited period of time. It can also be the case that Gorsuch has learned from Kennedy and knows how to get inside Kennedy arguments and how to defeat them. The fact of the matter is we just don't know how any justice is going to decide until they get on the bench. Kennedy has not really turned out to be the crazy conservative that some were really concerned about. And after Myers was dinged, who was thought to be more moderate, we wound up getting Alito, who is definitely more conservative. So ultimately, then, it's hard to tell.
And of course, this is Donald Trump's first nomination to the Supreme Court. Given our strange system of judges lasting as long as they want to or can stay in office, he may or may not get more. What do you expect maybe from future appointments?
So you have to remember that the average age of the current justice is quite high these days. And you have Kennedy, I believe, at 80 and Ginsburg at 83. I think those are roughly the numbers. They are starting to think about retiring, and I think that part of the reason why the Democrats are throwing up such bluster about this, they almost sort of have to. They just have to be careful about how they do it. They can see the appointments coming on down the road. So for Gorsuch, who's replacing a Scalia seat, there may not be that much of a visible change. But you've got to remember, Trump is going to be around for 4 more years, and those appointments are the ones that are going to be the real battleground. And if you think there's ill will now, get ready.
Kimmy, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
You betcha.
That's Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas. She joins to talk about Neil Gorsuch, who was nominated last night by President Trump to fill a vacant Supreme Court seat.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get two perspectives on what has worked and what has not worked with the Obamacare system from two Wisconsin doctors.
Right now, it's time for our weekly check-in on some of the latest political news out of Washington, D.C. The latest numbers are in about whether or not Americans approve of the job President Trump is doing early on in his tenure.
And President Trump's immigration and refugee executive order has received backlash nationwide as it went into effect last week. But could this executive order get public approval? We'll talk about that and the latest news in Senate confirmation hearings and more.
Harry Enten is with us now. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start with some numbers. Gallup poll released President Trump's disapproval ratings last week. Where are they?
Well, we have seen now a majority of people disapprove of Donald Trump's job as president, according to Gallup. The latest number has his disapproval rating at 52%. Usually it takes a year or more for someone's disapproval rating to get to a majority, and Trump's managed to do it in about a week. So not a great start, according to Gallup, for Donald Trump.
We are in a highly polarized time. Do most presidents, do all presidents, at least in recent memory, hit that majority disapproval rating at some point?
Yeah, they do. They hit it at some point, but it's usually closer to, say, a midterm election, or it takes, you know, in the case of George W. Bush, it took a while because 9/11 hit. But the idea of it occurring so soon in the presidency, that's what's unique. It's not, you know, unique to say, okay, Donald Trump's approval rating didn't jump up to, say, 65-70% after his inauguration, because honeymoon periods have been becoming shorter and shorter. What's unique here is that he's already at a majority disapproval, according to Gallup. Just never seen anything like that so early on in a presidency.
And these numbers were pulled together before the executive order on immigration and refugees, which was implemented last week. How do you see his numbers being affected by that?
Well, you know, we're starting to get some numbers from understanding exactly where Americans feel on that. And also the Gallup tracking poll is starting to get some days that take into account that numbers. It doesn't seem to me, looking at the overall approval ratings, that we've seen too much movement on it, which shouldn't be so surprising given, as you mentioned, things are so polarized these days that the people who don't like Trump already don't like him, and the people that do like him are pretty much going to stick with him, hell or high water, until something perhaps breaks the dam at some point. But I don't think this executive order seems to be it.
So in speaking of this executive order on immigration and refugees, you looked at it in a piece for 538.com this week. And what made you decide to take a look at where people stood on this?
Well, I mean, look, I think the one thing that we've learned from the Trump presidency that either the Trump opponents or the Trump supporters can agree upon is that he makes news pretty much every day. And this executive order made news very, very quickly. You know, whether you're pro or con, this is something that Donald Trump said he was going to do, and it was important to take a look at it. And in looking at it, what's so interesting to me, and something that we're going to have to wait and see how it develops, is it really becomes a question of how you frame it or how this entire issue gets framed. If this issue becomes framed as, say, an anti-Muslim issue or an anti-Muslim executive order, there's far less support for it than, say, if it's about protecting us from terrorists. If that's where this sort of the narrative frame goes, then this may in fact be, although perhaps not overwhelmingly popular, could find a home among a majority of voters in this country.
Right. So given that this is something that has a lot of different issues packed into one big issue, I mean, are you comfortable with the numbers you got, or do you think that it's not really for sure what kind of a reading you're getting on?
Yeah, I think that this is going to be the type of thing where we need to wait a while to understand exactly how the public is going to view this, because it's a very complex issue, as you said, with many moving parts. You have refugees as part of it. You know, you have absolute outright immigration bans and other parts of it. So it's a very complex issue, and I think it's going to take time to develop. And this is the type of thing where I wouldn't look at snap polling. I think it's the type of thing where we're going to need to look at, say, polling a few weeks or a few months down the line.
So given all of that, what is the area that seems to have the most potential for broad public support?
I think, you know, the area that has the most area for broad public support is if, as Trump has argued, this is not a ban, or depends on the day, I guess, a ban against Muslims, but this is the idea being that we need to tighten up our security measures. And if, in fact, this is about improving national security, Quinnipiac University asked, you know, do you support suspending immigration from terror-prone regions, even if it means turning away refugees from those regions? That's something that has at least plurality support. And one other thing I'll note that has a good amount of support is limiting the number of refugees. People perhaps don't want to say no more refugees. That perhaps is a step too far. But saying we want less than we're currently taking in, that's something that can find some support among the American people.
And that last bit, does that include refugees from anywhere in the world, or is that just looking at these seven countries?
That's looking at anywhere in the world. We haven't. There's been some very quick polling that was done in specific response to the immigration ban, but nothing that I trust too much yet. We're talking about polling that looks specifically at either Syria or more wide-ranging, where Americans are okay with limiting the number of refugees but don't want to cut it off completely.
We're talking with Harry Enten right now from 538.com, getting the latest out of Washington. And Harry, the confirmation hearings continue, and there's some progress for the Trump cabinet. Where are we today?
Well, we did get Rex Tillerson approved by the entire Senate. It was a close vote, 56-43, which perhaps doesn't sound that tight given, you know, how polarized we are. But the Secretary of State is usually a position that overwhelmingly flies through. Remember, Hillary Clinton and John Kerry were approved overwhelmingly, and the idea that you would have this many no votes is just something, if you had asked someone who studied this 5 or 6 years ago, would come up as a major surprise. But Tillerson did get through, and now the real question is around Betsy DeVos, who's going for Secretary of Education, and it seems as though they're going to have the votes there, but it looks like it's going to be the closest it could possibly be with, say, a 51-50 split, with Vice President Pence casting the tie-breaking vote.
How contentious have these cabinet hearings been? I know there was a dust-up between Senator Al Franken and Ted Cruz, actually. I don't know if they were both in the room at the same time. But
they were not.
There were some difficult moments there. But how contentious overall have these hearings been?
I would say that these have been the most, you know, obviously we can't say for sure, you know, how senators feedback against one another. But to me, this looks like the most contentious hearings we've basically ever had. And you can see it in the yes-no votes, where there are a ton more no votes that are coming out. Usually cabinet positions are easily filled. I think before this year, dating back to 1977, the average candidate got an average of 3 no votes. That's going to be well above that this year. So, you know, Washington is no longer a place where everyone gets along. If it ever was, it certainly isn't the case right now.
Yeah, what does it feel like right now? It's I guess, unclear for Democrats whether, as in the past, constituents wanted to see there be ability to work together, some bipartisan goodwill, or do they just want whatever side they're on to be oppositional?
I think they want whatever side they're on to be oppositional. I mean, I'm getting texts from people I haven't heard from in 5 years wondering who should they call, which senator they should call in order to change their mind, who is the key vote. People, constituents, really want to get involved. They want their senators to vote the party line, and that's what it's really become. The idea of decorum and, you know, giving in to the other side or working together just doesn't seem to hold any water anymore. It's all about fight, 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 and support your party's position.
Some big news last night from President Trump. He announced his Supreme Court pick, Neil Gorsuch, and he's considered to be very much in the Scalia lineage. So what are your thoughts about this pick and how it could go over?
Well, you know, this is the type of pick that certainly is payback for conservatives who perhaps weren't the biggest fans, especially intellectual conservatives, of Donald Trump. Trump may be many things, but conservative in the traditional sense, he is not. This is a pick that they love, and that a lot of liberals really don't like, but it's also a nominee who pretty much everybody agrees is well qualified. But it's going to be one in which he will probably get confirmed, but I wouldn't expect more than, say, 55 to 60 votes, with the real question being whether or not cloture is able to be enacted. That is, if they can end the filibuster. If they can, he'll get confirmed, because I would doubt any Republicans vote against it. But the question is whether they can get those 8 Democrats to vote for cloture. My guess is they probably will be able to, but we'll see what happens.
Any indications so far? I think last night on Twitter I saw that there were 5 Democrats being reported against this pick already.
Yeah, I mean, look, the vast majority of Democrats are going to be against this pick. I modeled out, you know, what number of votes do we expect each type of nominee to get? Someone who is as conservative as Gorsuch is, we expect a lot of no votes. The question is, can they pick off those few Democrats on the side? And that's, I guess, what we'll see in the days and weeks to go. Again, I don't think that he'll get 60 votes for confirmation. The question is whether he can get 60 votes for cloture, and that's what we'll have to keep an eye on. And if he can't, will Republicans use the nuclear option to say, you know what, all Supreme Court nominees from now on will be up or down votes, you can't filibuster them.
And what happens if they do that? I mean, you said the mood in Capitol Hill is rough already. What do you see happening if that happens?
I guess they're going to take a 2-foot snowstorm and turn it into a blizzard with 35-mile-an-hour winds. That's what they're going to do. There's always a way to find more distrust between colleagues in Washington, D.C. If you want a friend, get a dog.
That's a good place to leave it, Harry. Thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. He was with us there to catch up with the latest in national political news.
Coming up after the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, we'll hear from 2 Wisconsin doctors with different perspectives, different insights on the strengths and weaknesses of Obamacare, and look at what might come next if it is repealed. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll talk with a Republican state representative about new legislation in the state on mandatory reporting of child abuse, right to try legislation for terminally ill patients, and more.
First, the future of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, is up in the air. President Donald Trump made repeal of President Obama's signature policy a main campaign point. And while it's not clear yet what would replace it, the movement in Congress is to follow the lead of the White House.
We've asked 2 Wisconsin doctors to share their experiences and perspectives with us today on what has and hasn't worked with Obamacare and what it's meant for health care in our state.
Dr. Syed Asaf joins us now. He's an anesthesiologist in Green Bay. He's affiliated with Bellin Memorial Hospital. He's president of the Bellin Health Partners, which works to deliver health care to patients. He co-authored an opinion piece for USA Today Network Wisconsin back before the election. It was titled, "Doctors, We Can Do Better Than Obamacare." We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Dr. Asaf, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, in that opinion piece I just mentioned, you co-authored it with a few other doctors. You wrote, no matter which political party claims victory, they'll find their predecessor's crowning achievement, the Affordable Care Act, dead on arrival. So what led you to that conclusion?
What led me to that conclusion is just simply looking at the number of healthcare providers, insurers that were entering the individual market in the exchanges. The numbers are actually diminishing substantially, and the premiums are escalating substantially. It is entering a death spiral. If this was a vibrant market where it was delivering clear value to patients, we would expect to see more providers entering and premiums reducing, and that is precisely what we do not find. Because Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, was founded on a shaky economic foundation, and essentially deployed a top-down mechanism of controlling what is a very large segment of our economy, and that has not worked. We have to acknowledge that. Now, I do want to to turn the heat down a little bit, because I think this issue is way too politicized. It's important to remember that that what we are doing here is talking about a public policy that affects a healthcare system that will provide care for us, for our families, no one party will have a monopoly on the truth here, partisan bickership, bickering, and this divided government is actually very likely to lead us to worse policy than better policy. So it's important to acknowledge that not all of what Affordable Care Act has done has been bad, but that there are some very substantial bad things in it that need to be changed, while preserving what it has done that is good.
From your perspective, how has the Affordable Care Act, maybe the marketplace in particular, affected where you practice and the patients you see come through there?
Well, what we see, for example, in my area, there's only three providers now on the exchange. We have had the exiting of Arise, Prevail 360, and of United Healthcare from the exchange. The three remaining, we're seeing a 20% increase in premiums in Anthem Blue Cross, a 28% increase in Common Ground, and a 27% increase in Molina Healthcare. So these are just this year's increase in premiums. Important to understand also, 85% of the people that are enrolling in these plans are receiving subsidies. So this market is not a true market, because we have subsidies on both sides of this. That is, the purchasers are getting subsidized, as are the providers. And this concept of the risk corridors, which is regulations inside the Affordable Care Act to try to stabilize this market and attract providers to come into this market, has failed dramatically. The federal government essentially shorted insurers some $2.5 billion of their losses that were supposed to be paid back, and this is the approximate reason why people are exiting. United Healthcare has lost $1 billion on these exchanges. That's why it is no longer participating, and I think the Affordable Care Act insufficiently focuses on the principal drivers of cost, because if you're even when we're talking about access reducing the number of uninsured, which is a laudable goal that we should have, if we are focusing on that, then we must focus on the core causes of escalation of healthcare costs and do our best to reduce those, because fundamentally lack of access is related to cost escalation.
We're talking to Dr. Syed Asif from Green Bay with his perspective on the Affordable Care Act. And Dr. Asif, people have pointed out, we've got millions more people covered since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and healthcare costs, well, they're not going down, but they're increasing at a somewhat slower rate, people are saying, than before it came into effect. So isn't that a win to some extent?
The covering of 20 million additional people is a win. And that is great. And as we look at how to fix this, we must focus on making sure that we don't go back to 50 million Americans not having insurance. Okay. So that's a fundamental. But if you think back say that we have given people a piece of paper that says they have insurance, yet we haven't really figured out how to fund it, then we haven't given them much, because this is not sustainable. We have to build this on a solid economic foundation. And a solid economic foundation is one that focuses on creation of value. One of the bright spots of what has happened politically in healthcare policy is the bipartisan passage of the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act, MACRA, that tries to reform the reimbursement system to value-based, and therefore incentivizes, aligns the incentives of the providers with that of the interests of the patients. So what we need more than anything else is a is free market competition in a way that allows organizations and institutions that can get together and provide healthcare at a lower cost and higher quality, that they get rewarded. That is how we get to lower costs, and when we get to lower costs, we get to more people insured.
One concern raised about the market is maybe in more of a free market, less government-restricted healthcare market, there's an incentive to serve the wealthiest people, the people who can afford the healthcare the most, and the people who can afford it least get left behind in that market approach. How do you square that?
Because what we have to do is we have to ensure there's transparency and there's value creation. So when we create value, which means we provide great healthcare outcomes at the lowest possible cost, we are not appealing or designing products for the wealthiest. In fact, by lowering the cost of services, we're making these services more accessible to the less wealthy. That is, I think, the critical area that we should focus on.
Briefly, as we wrap up, what are you looking for? The Affordable Care Act is going to change or go away. What is your top priority when it comes to replacing it?
My top priority is a focus on value creation. That is, looking at ways that we reimburse and we purchase services. We have traditionally purchased healthcare services as I buy, you sell, she pays. If you buy and sell any goods and services under that formula, the cost will escalate. We now need to focus on what we have over 240 years of tradition of free market activity, which reduces cost and improves quality. And so we need to remove the barriers of free that get in the way of free competition. We have to reform how we pay for healthcare so that we pay for value, and let the institutions compete on value creation. Those who succeed should be rewarded in that system.
Dr. Asif, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Saeed Asif. He's an anesthesiologist in Green Bay, affiliated with Bellin Memorial Hospital. He's also president of Bellin Health Partners. He co-authored an opinion piece for USA Today Network Wisconsin back in November titled, "Doctors, We Can Do Better Than Obamacare." We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page.
In just a bit, Dr. Greg Sheehy joins us to share his perspectives on Obamacare and its impact on healthcare here in Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We just heard from Dr. Saeed Asif about where he sees weaknesses in Obamacare and the impact of medical care in Wisconsin.
Dr. Greg Sheehy of Middleton joins us now. He's a retired doctor who practiced and taught in the Madison area for 34 years. He published an opinion piece in the Wisconsin State Journal a couple weeks ago titled, "My Experience at a Free Clinic Showed Obamacare is Working." That article is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Dr. Sheehy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
You've been practicing medicine for several decades. What did you see as the problems with our healthcare system in the U.S. Before the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think the biggest problem has been the fee-for-service aspect of it. You do more procedures, you do more tests, you do more visits, and the cost goes up. And the incentives were not good incentives. Initially, it wasn't too bad when insurance first came into being, but subsequently, it has become very problematic.
And as a physician, what did you see as the impact of Obamacare?
Well, when the Affordable Care Act was enacted, it was enacted with a correlation with Medicare and Medicaid, and there were a number of programs, projects, to try to change to what Dr. Asif talked about as far as value care. That value care issue has really been stimulated by the Affordable Care Act. We need to obtain value and not so much production.
And you wrote in your piece that your position on the Affordable Care Act was shaped a lot by your experiences working in a free clinic in Door County. What about that influenced you?
Well, I do want to clarify the newspaper put the free clinic. We did have some very modest fees, so it wasn't completely free. When I wrote the article, I said the ACA, one physician's view and experience. But aside from that, what we saw is that when people who were coming to our clinic in Door County, we took no insurance under any circumstance. They were individuals who were working practically full-time, but unfortunately at part-time jobs or seasonal jobs, and so they didn't have any health insurance. And when the Affordable Care Act became available, people who had never had health insurance suddenly had health insurance. Yes, the premiums are there. Yes, the deductibles and copays. But we saw some wonderful things happening to people who had neglected their health.
Ultimately, I understand it put the clinic out of business because people actually had insurance and didn't need this clinic of last resort for them.
It did. I started working there in 2012, and within about 18 months, the first 12 months were before the act actually became noteworthy. And then over the next 6 to 12 months, the number of patients I saw fell such that after a year and a half of the Affordable Care Act, we were down about 60% of our patients.
Which usually, for a business, that's bad news. You were happy to see this happening.
That's correct. We were happy in the sense that people were now getting health care.
Now, we've seen the critiques of the Affordable Care Act, fewer participators providing in the marketplace exchanges. Premiums started off at one level, big jumps last fall for people in Wisconsin and around the country. Worries that those two facts meant it might be nice, but it's not really sustainable. What do you think about that?
Well, I think there are lots of ways to approach that. I am on Medicare, and I have a supplemental insurance plan, and my supplemental insurance plan went up 11% this year. There's no question that when the Affordable Care Act, in this first year, the premiums were set too low. The expectations were more of a healthy population being enrolled. They got a sicker population. As a result, that increased premiums. There was another thing that Congress did that really undermined the Affordable Care Act, and that was in 2014 when Congress moved to not pay for the risk corridor. The risk corridor was in the Affordable Care Act, and it was going to buffer insurance companies for taking the risk on this unknown population. And basically, the insurance companies received 10 cents on the dollar. Now, that's a pretty severe penalty for these insurance carriers, and how else are they going to get that money back except by raising premiums?
We're seeing, we just saw the end of what might be the last Affordable Care Act sign-up period. What are your concerns for people who in the last few years maybe got, as you said, their first insurance ever?
Well, I think there certainly could be a dropout rate, both from the standpoint of the premiums and the copays, et cetera. There are issues, just like Dr. Assef mentioned. Providers are dropping out. Insurance companies are dropping out. But I think that if you look at the Affordable Care Act, 60%, it was really the expansion of Medicaid. And you haven't asked me this, but I think if the Trump administration wants to kill the Affordable Care Act, they can do it by expanding Medicaid.
Do you think that's a likely solution?
No.
We're talking about the impact of the Affordable Care Act on Wisconsin and the impact of the end, possibly, of the Affordable Care Act. Dr. Greg Sheehy of Middleton is with us. He's practiced in the Madison area for 34 years, wrote a piece on the topic. We also just heard from Dr. Saeed Assef from the Green Bay area about this. So the Affordable Care Act, as I was saying earlier, likely on the way out one way or another. What do you hope members of Congress keep in mind as they start to try to figure out what happens next to replace the Affordable Care Act as they repeal it?
Well, the number one thing they need to keep in mind is that this is really a public health issue. And if they look at it strictly as partisanship, people are going to suffer. And that would be my hope, that they would look at it as a public health issue. I think the other thing is they have to look really carefully at what the Affordable Care Act has really done in getting people health care that they badly needed and are benefiting from it. A healthier population is good for the country. And I will say this as an aside. Just recently, there was a big study done on Michigan, which expanded their Medicaid. And that has been an economic bonanza for the state of Michigan. We don't think of these things, but all of a sudden the federal government is absorbing Medicaid. Those dollars that Michigan used to put into it is now being spread around the United States.
So you're worried about not just a health, but an economic impact if that support goes away?
I think so. I think that's going to cause a definite downswing, but I'm mainly concerned about the health of our citizens.
We're hearing from Dr. SF, and we've heard this for a while now, even before the Affordable Care Act, about just the fundamental rising costs of health care, regardless of who's paying for it, whether it's somebody paying out of pocket, an employer, an insurance company, the federal government, you name it. What kind of things do you think could help start lowering those overall costs, again, regardless of who's paying the bill ultimately?
Single-payer plan.
How so? I mean, money's still coming from the taxpayers in that case.
It is, but we have seen that every time, first of all, we talk about the free market. The free market has created this problem. We started with health insurance in around 1947-48. We've had 70 years of the free market, and look what it's given us. It doesn't work in healthcare. So I think single payer has a lot of advantage. Medicare administrative costs 2%. Affordable Care Act is approaching 20% just because we're dealing with private insurers. When Medicare was expanded with Medicare Advantage, the administrative costs went very high. We can't afford to have that happen again. The free market will not work.
A lot of people hear the idea of single payer and think, you know, I don't know. I feel uncomfortable with the idea of ultimately the government making healthcare decisions and maybe prioritizing different kinds of healthcare decisions.
Well, they look at it from a standpoint that seems to be un-American. I don't know why. We have police departments. We have fire departments. But I'll also say that when we look at healthcare, we have lots to look towards. All of the developed countries have single payer, and they do so much better. And I think we just have to learn from that. I think if people could see that they would get more healthcare for their dollar rather than administrative costs, they would pay attention to that. Our administrative costs are around 20% generally, and that's way too high. 20 cents on the dollar going to administration is nonsense.
Going back to the initial passage of the Affordable Care Act, were you disappointed when the idea of single payer or the so-called public option kind of fell by the wayside so quickly?
Absolutely. I thought that was a mistake, but it really, when you look back at it and all of the criticism of the Affordable Care Act, I certainly understand why President Obama and those people decided that they had to take it off the table, because this is a private plan. If you look at it, it's not a government plan in the true sense, and it's been attacked relentlessly. A single payer wouldn't have had a chance.
Assuming we don't get single payer in the next few years, what would you like to what would improve the Affordable Care Act? If some of it stays in place, what one step would you like to see to improve it?
Well, I think going to the value-based care is important. We talk about fee-for-service, and a lot of people just don't grasp that, but we need to not compensate drug companies, not compensate medical device makers, not compensate physicians for doing more that is not really necessary. And that's really been our system. We have rewarded people for being inefficient. We've rewarded them for doing too much.
Dr. Sheehy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Dr. Greg Sheehy. He's a retired doctor who practiced and taught in the Madison area for 34 years. He published an opinion piece in the Wisconsin State Journal a couple weeks back. It was titled, "My Experience at a Free Clinic." Not really free. Headline was wrong. It sounds like a showed Obamacare is working. That article is linked, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. We also have the article co-written by Dr. Saeed Asif, who we spoke with earlier. And while you're over at the Central Time Facebook page checking those out, share your thoughts on how the Affordable Care Act has affected you for better or for worse, and what you are hoping for as it gets repealed and replaced, what you fear, what you want to see from Republicans in Congress and the Trump administration when it comes to the future of American healthcare. Again, read both of those perspectives from Wisconsin doctors and share your thoughts on the future of healthcare over at the Central Time Facebook page.
If you've been online today, you may have seen a lot of links and headlines about a looming bacon shortage, with national reserves at a 50-year low, according to information from the USDA.
Now, you may be the sort of person who hears that, and you're on your way out to the car to run to the store and stock up on bacon and buy a freezer. Don't do these things. Do not start hoarding bacon. Looks like there will, in fact, be no actual bacon shortage. Experts say, yeah, reserves of bacon, they've gone down. The price has gone up a little bit in response. But we are nowhere near running out of bacon.
Which is good for bacon lovers, because the online response to the possible shortage was a little bit panicked, to say the least. And it looks like the story was spread in part by the people at the Ohio Pork Council, which also created the website baconshortage.com.
Which, again, apparently no bacon shortage. People love bacon. I've known vegetarians who the one thing they'd cave for was bacon. I started calling them bacontarians. I don't think that's really a philosophy, though.
You know, I don't know. I'm not. I like my turkey bacon. This did not hit me particularly hard. I also like tempeh bacon, other forms of veggie bacon. Eh, what's the big deal about bacon?
I like the real stuff. I like the totally vegetarian stuff. The turkey stuff, I've told you, have a hard time. It either is raw or it's burnt.
That's
I can't
wrong.
Find that sweet
no,
spot.
No, it's delicious.
We'll have to do a Food Friday making turkey bacon. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.